When we pass from looking to seeing, we do not therefore lose our sight of the objects observed. Seeing, in fact, does not disturb our looking at all. It rather places us in that territory as its genius, aware that our imagination does not create within its outlines, but creates the outlines themselves. The physicist who sees speaks physics with us, inviting us to see that the things we thought were there are not things at all. By learning new limitations from such a person, we learn not only what to look for with them, but also how to see the way we use limitations. A physics so taught becomes poiesis. 53. To be the genius of myself is not to bring myself into being. As the origin of myself, I am not also the cause of myself, as though I were the product of my own action. But then, neither am I the product of any other action. My parents may have wanted a child, but they could not have wanted me. I am both the outcome of my past and the transformation of my past. To be related to the past as its outcome is to stand in casual continuity with it. Such a relation can be accounted for in scientific explanation. I can be said to be the result of precise genetic influence. The date and place of my birth are matters of causal necessity. I had no part in deciding either. Neither could anyone else have chosen them. My birth, when understood in terms of causal continuity, marks no absolute beginning. It marks nothing at all, except an arbitrary point in an unbroken process. Causally speaking, there is nothing new here, only the kinds of change that conform to the known laws of nature. Speaking in purely causal terms, I cannot say I was born. I should say, rather, that I have emerged as a phase in the process of reproduction. A reproduction is a repetition, a recurrence of that which has been. Birth, on the other hand, in causal terms, is all discontinuity. It has its beginnings in itself and can be caused by nothing. It makes no sense to say I was reproduced on this date and in this place. To say I was born is to speak of myself as having an uncaused point of departure within the realm of the continuous, an absolute beginning not comprehensible to the explanatory intelligence. As such a phenomenon, birth repeats nothing. It is not the outcome of the past, but the recasting of a drama already underway. A birth is an event in the ongoing history of a family, even the history of a culture. The radical originality of a birth announces itself in the way it brings the dramatic into conflict with the theatrical in cultural or family history. Theatrically, my birth is an event of plotted repetition. I am born as another member of my family and my culture. Who I am is a question already answered by the content and character of a tradition. Dramatically, my birth is the rupture of that repetitive sequence, an event certain to change what the past has meant. In this case, the character of a tradition is determined by who I am. Dramatically speaking, every birth is the birth of genius. The drama underway at the time of my birth is moved forward to new possibilities by the appearance of a new genius within it. It is a drama, however, already peopled by finite players attempting to forget, playing for keeps. If I am born into and add to the culture of a family, I am also a product and a citizen of its politics. I first experience the conflict between the theatrical and the dramatic in the felt pressure to take up one of the roles prepared for me. Eldest son, favorite daughter, heir to the family's honor, avenger of its losses. Each of these roles comes, of course, with a script, one whose lines a person might easily spend a lifetime repeating, while intentionally forgetting or repressing the fact that it is but a learned script. Such a person is obliged to repeat the repressed material as a contemporary experience, instead of, as the physician would prefer to see, remembering it as something belonging to the past. Freud. It is the genius in us who knows that the past is most definitely past, and therefore not forever sealed, but forever open to creative reinterpretation. 54. Not allowing the past to be past may be the primary source for the seriousness of finite players. Inasmuch as finite play always has its audience, it is the audience to whom the finite player intends to be known as winner. The finite player, in other words, must not only have an audience, but must have an audience to convince. Just as the titles of winners are worthless unless they are visible to others, there is a kind of anti-title that attaches to invisibility. To the degree that we are invisible, we have a past that has condemned us to oblivion. It is as though we have somehow been overlooked, even forgotten, by our chosen audience. If it is the winners who are presently visible, it is the losers who are invisibly past. As we enter into finite play, not playfully but seriously, we come before an audience conscious that we bear the antititles of invisibility. We feel the need, therefore, to prove to them that we are not what we think they think we are, or, more precisely, that we were not who we think the audience thinks we were. As with all finite play, an acute contradiction quickly develops at the heart of this attempt. As finite players, we will not enter the game with sufficient desire to win unless we are ourselves convinced by the very audience we intend to convince. That is, unless we believe we actually are the losers the audience sees us to be, we will not have the necessary desire to win. The more negatively we assess ourselves, the more we strive to reverse the negative judgment of others. The outcome brings the contradiction to perfection. By proving to the audience they were wrong, we prove to ourselves the audience was right. The more we are recognized as winners, the more we know ourselves to be losers. That is why it is rare for the winners of highly coveted and publicized prizes to settle for their titles and retire. Winners, especially celebrated winners, must prove repeatedly they are winners. The script must be played over and over again. Titles must be defended by new contests. No one is ever wealthy enough, honored enough, applauded enough. On the contrary, the visibility of our victories only tightens the grip of the failures in our invisible past. So crucial is this power of the past to finite play that we must find ways of remembering that we have been forgotten to sustain our interest in the struggle. There is a humiliating memory at the bottom of all serious conflicts. Remember the Alamo, remember the Maine, remember Pearl Harbor. These are the cries that carried Americans into several wars. Having once been insulted by Athens, the great Persian emperor Darius renewed his appetite for war by having a page follow him about to whisper in his ear, "Sire, remember the Athenians." Indeed, it is only by remembering what we have forgotten that we can enter into competition with sufficient intensity to be able to forget we have forgotten the character of all play. Whoever must play cannot play. Whenever we act as the genius of ourselves, it will be in the spirit of allowing the past to be past. It is the genius in us who is capable of ridding us of resentment by exercising what Nietzsche called the faculty of oblivion, not as a way of denying the past, but as a way of reshaping it through our own originality. Then we forget that we have been forgotten by an audience, and remember that we have forgotten our freedom to play. 55. If in the culture into which we are born there are always persons who will urge us to theatricalize our lives by supplying us with a repeatable past, there will also be persons, possibly the same ones, in whose presence we learn to prepare ourselves for surprise. It is in the presence of such persons that we first recognize ourselves as the geniuses we are. These persons do not give us our genius or produce it in us. In no way is the source of genius external to itself. Never is a child moved to genius. Genius arises with touch. Touch is a characteristically paradoxical phenomenon of infinite play. I am not touched by another when the distance between us is reduced to zero. I am touched only if I respond from my own center, that is, spontaneously, originally. But you do not touch me except from your own center, out of your own genius. Touching is always reciprocal. You cannot touch me unless I touch you in response. The opposite of touching is moving. You move me by pressing me from without toward a place you have already foreseen and perhaps prepared. It is a staged action that succeeds only if in moving me you remain unmoved yourself. I can be moved to tears by skilled performances and heart-rending newspaper accounts, or moved to passion by political manifestos and narratives of heroic achievement. But in each case, I am moved according to a formula or design to which the actor or agent is immune. When actors bring themselves to tears by their performance, and not as their performance, they have failed their craft. They have become theatrically inept. This means that we can be moved only by persons who are not what they are. We can be moved only when we are not who we are, but are what we cannot be. When I am touched only as the person I am behind all the theatrical masks. But at the same time, I am changed from within, and whoever touches me is touched as well. We do not touch by design. Indeed, all designs are shattered by touching. Whoever touches and whoever is touched cannot but be surprised. The unpredictability of this phenomenon is reflected in our reference to the insane as touched. We can be moved only by way of our veils. We are touched through our veils. 56. The character of touching can be seen quite clearly in the way infinite players understand both healing and sexuality. If to be touched is to respond from one center, it is also to respond as a whole person. To be whole is to be hale or healthy. In sum, whoever is touched is healed. The finite player's interest is not in being healed or made whole, but in being cured or made functional. Healing restores me to play. Curing restores me to competition in one or another game. Physicians who cure must abstract persons into functions. They treat the illness, not the person. And persons willfully present themselves as functions. Indeed, what sustains the enormous size and cost of the curing professions is the widespread desire to see oneself as a function or a collection of functions. To be ill is to be dysfunctional. To be dysfunctional is to be unable to compete in one's preferred contests. It is a kind of death, an inability to acquire titles. The ill become invisible. Illness always has the smell of death about it. Either it may lead to death or it leads to the death of a person as competitor. The dread of illness is the dread of losing. One is never ill in general. One is always ill with relation to some bounded activity. It is not cancer that makes me ill. It is because I cannot work or run or swallow that I am ill with cancer. The loss of function, the obstruction of an activity, cannot in itself destroy my health. I am too heavy to fly by flapping my arms, but I do not for that reason complain of being sick with weight. However, if I desired to be a fashion model, a dancer, or a jockey, I would consider excessive weight to be a kind of disease, and would be likely to consult a doctor, a nutritionist, or another specialist to be cured of it. When I am healed, I am restored to my center in a way that my freedom as a person is not compromised by my loss of functions. This means that the illness need not be eliminated before I can be healed. I am not free to the degree that I can overcome my infirmities, but only to the degree that I can put my infirmities into play. I am cured of my illness. I am healed with my illness. Healing, of course, has all the reciprocity of touching. Just as I cannot touch myself, I cannot heal myself. But healing requires no specialists, only those who can come to us out of their own center, and who are prepared to be healed themselves. 57. Sexuality for the infinite player is entirely a matter of touch. One cannot touch without touching sexually. Because sexuality is a drama of origins, it gives full expression to the genius you are and to the genius of others who participate in that drama. This throws a high challenge before the political ideologue. Aware that genuine sexual expression is at least as dangerous to society as genuine artistic expression, the sexual metaphysician can appeal to at least two powerful solutions. One is to treat sexuality as a process of reproduction. Another is to place it in the area of feeling and behavior. Although reproduction is a process that operates by way of our bodies, it nonetheless operates autonomously. Like every other natural process, it is a phenomenon of causal continuity, having no inherent beginning or end. Therefore, we cannot be said to initiate the process by any act of our own. We can only be carried along by it, inasmuch as conception occurs only when all the necessary conditions have been met by the parenting couple. No one conceives a child. A child is conceived in the conjunction of sperm and ovum. The mother does not give birth to a child. The mother is where the birth occurs. The metaphysics of sexuality, applying to this solution, can therefore draw a boundary line around sexual activity that leaves the genius of parenting altogether outside it. Thus, the familiar view of some Christian theologians who say that the only end of the sexual act is procreation. But this metaphysics, committed as it is to the continuity of the process, also leaves the genius of the child entirely outside it. Thus, the familiar view of theologians who say that the end of childbirth is to provide citizens for the kingdom of God. Metaphysically understood, sexuality has nothing to do with our existence as persons, for it views persons as expressions of sexuality, and not sexuality as the expression of persons. The second way of veiling genuine sexuality is to regard it as a feeling or as a kind of behavior. In either case, it has the character of something under observation. Even if it is our own sexuality we are concerned with, we can still look on it from without, making an assessment of it as though it were of another person. We ask ourselves and each other whether certain behavior is acceptable or desirable. We are puzzled over the proper response to sexual feelings, ours or another's. Sexuality can in this way be dealt with as a societal phenomenon, regulated and managed according to the prevailing ideology. Sexual rebels, violators of the sexual taboos, do not weaken this ideology, but affirm it as the rules of finite play. It is convenient to think that sexual misfits violate rules. The matter is subtler by far. They are not concerned to oppose the rules themselves, but to engage in competitive struggle by way of those rules. Sexual attractiveness, or sexiness, is effective only to the degree that someone is offended by it. Pornography is exciting only so far as it reveals something forbidden, something otherwise unseeable. Thus, the mandatory hostility in it, the quality of shock and violence. Because sexuality is so rich in the mystery of origin, it becomes a region of human action deeply shaped by resentment, where participants play out a manifold strategy of hostile encounters. The players in finite sexuality not only require the offended resistance of those who refuse to join them in their play, they require the resistance of those who do join them. Sexual plotting on the part of one player is, in fact, stimulated by disinterest or fear or loathing on the part of the other. A master player of finite sexuality chooses not to take these attitudes as a way of refusing the sexual game, but takes them to be part of the game. Thus, my indifference or revulsion to your sexuality becomes in your masterful play a sexual indifference, a sexual revulsion. Suddenly, I am no longer indifferent to your game, but indifferent to you within your game, and have ipso facto made myself your opponent. This is the plot of the classical pulp novel and of Hollywood romance, Indifferent Girl Won by Ardent Boy. The profound seriousness of such sexual play is seen in the unique nature of the prize that goes to the winner. What one wants in the sexual contest is not just to have defeated the other, but to have the defeated other. Sexuality is the only finite game in which the winner's prize is the defeated opponent. Sexual titles, like all other titles, have appropriately conspicuous emblems. However, only in sexuality do persons themselves become property. In slavery or wage labor, what we possess is not the persons of the slaves or the workers, but the products of their labors. In this case, to use Marx's phrase, persons are abstracted from their labor. But in sexuality, persons are abstracted from themselves. The seduced opponent is so displayed as to draw public attention to the seducer's triumph. In the complex plotting of sexual encounter, it is by no means uncommon for the partners to have played a double game in which each is the winner and loser, and each is an emblem for the other's seductive power. A society shows its mastery in the management of sexuality not when it sets out unambiguous standards for sexual behavior or prescribed attitudes towards sexual feelings, but when it institutionalizes the emblematic display of sexual conquest. These institutions can be as varied as burning widows alive on the funeral pyres of their husbands, or requiring the high visibility of a spouse at an elected official's inauguration. Finite sexuality is a form of theater in which the distance between persons is regularly reduced to zero, but in which neither touches the other. 58. Insofar as sexuality is a drama of origin, it is original to society and not derivative of it. It is therefore somewhat misleading to describe society as a regulator of finite sexual play. It is more the case that finite sexuality shapes society than is shaped by it. Only to a limited extent do we take on the sexual roles assigned us by society. Much more frequently, we enter into societal arrangements by way of sexual roles. For example, we are more likely to refer to the king as the father of the country than we are to refer to the father as king of the family. While society does serve a regulatory function, it is probably more correctly understood as sexuality making use of society to regulate itself. This means that society plays little or no role in either causing or preventing sexual tensions. On the contrary, society absorbs sexual tensions into all of its structures. It becomes the larger theater for playing out the patterns of resentment learned in the family. Society is where we prove to parents qua audience that we are not what we thought they thought we were. Since the emphasis in this relationship is not on what our parents thought of us, but on what we thought, they become an audience that easily survives their physical absence or death. Moreover, for the same reason, they become an audience whose definitive approval we can never win. To use Freud's famous phrase, the civilized are therefore the discontent. We do not become losers in civilization, but become civilized as losers. The collective result of this ineradicable sense of failure is that civilizations take on the spirit of resentment. Acutely sensitive to an imagined audience, they are easily offended by other civilizations. Indeed, even the most powerful societies can be embarrassed by the weakest. The Soviet Union by Afghanistan, Great Britain by Argentina, the United States by Grenada. This is also why the only true revolutionary act is not the overthrow of the father by the son, which only reinforces the existing patterns of resentment, but the restoration of genius to sexuality. It is by no means an accident that the only successful attempt of the American citizenry to force the ending of a foreign war occurred simultaneously with a wide revision in sexual attitudes. The civilization quickly recovered from this threat, however, by tempting these revolutionaries into a new sexual politics, one of societal standoff, where sexual genius is confused with such struggles as the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment and the election of women to national office. There is one other way in which society is shaped by the tensions of finite sexuality, in its orientation toward property. Since sexuality is the only finite game in which the winner's prize is the loser, the most desirable form of property is the publicly acknowledged possession of another's person, a relationship to which the possessed must, of course, freely consent. All other forms of property are considerably less desirable, even when they are vast in quantity. The true value of my property, in fact, varies not with its monetary worth, but with its effectiveness in winning for me the declaration that I am the master player in our game with each other. the most serious struggles are those for sexual property. For this, wars are fought, lives are generously risked, great schemes are initiated. However, who wins empire, fortune, and fame, but loses in love, has lost in everything. 59. Because finite or veiled sexuality is one or another struggle which its participants mean to win, it is oriented toward moments, outcomes, final scenes. Like all finite play, it proceeds largely by deception. Sexual desires are usually not directly announced, but concealed under a series of feints, gestures, styles of dress, and showy behavior. Seductions are staged, scripted, costumed. Certain responses are sought. Plots are developed. In skillful seductions, delays are employed, special circumstances and settings are arranged. Seductions are designed to come to an end. Time runs out. The play is finished. All that remains is recollection, the memory of a moment, and perhaps a longing for its repetition. Seductions cannot be repeated. Once one has won or lost in a particular finite game, the game cannot be played over. Moments once reached cannot be reached again. Lovers often sustain vivid reminders of extraordinary moments, but they are reminded at the same time of their impotence in recreating them. The appetite for novelty in lovemaking, new positions, the use of drugs, exotic surroundings, additional partners, is only a search for new moments that can live on only in recollection. As with all finite play, the goal of veiled sexuality is to bring itself to an end. 60. By contrast, infinite players have no interest in seduction or in restricting the freedom of another to one's own boundaries of play. Infinite players recognize choice in all aspects of sexuality. They may see in themselves and in others, for example, the infant's desire to compete for the mother, but they also see that there is neither a physiological nor societal destiny in sexual patterns. Who chooses to compete with another can also choose to play with another. Sexuality is not a bounded phenomenon, but a horizontal phenomenon for infinite players. One can never say, therefore, that an infinite player is homosexual or heterosexual or celibate or adulterous or faithful, because each of these definitions has to do with boundaries, with circumscribed areas and styles of play. Infinite players do not play within sexual boundaries, but with sexual boundaries. They are concerned not with power, but with vision. In their sexual play, they suffer others, allow them to be as they are. Suffering others, they open themselves. Open, they learn both about others and about themselves. Learning, they grow. What they learn is not about sexuality, but how to be more concretely and originally themselves, to be the genius of their own actions, to be whole. Moving, therefore, from an original center, the sexual engagements of infinite players have no standards, no ideals, no marks of success or failure. Neither orgasm nor conception is a goal in their play, although either may be part of the play. 61. There is nothing hidden in infinite sexuality. Sexual desire is exposed as sexual desire, and is never therefore serious. Its satisfaction is never an achievement, but an act in a continuing relationship, and therefore joyous. Its lack of satisfaction is never a failure, but only a matter to be taken on into further play. Infinite lovers may or may not have a family. Rousseau said the only human institution that is not conventional is the family, which for a brief time is required by nature. Rousseau erred. No family is united by natural or any other kind of necessity. Families can convene only out of choice. The family of infinite lovers has this difference, that it is self-evidently chosen. It is a progressive work of unveiling. Fathering and mothering are roles freely assumed, but always with the design of showing them to be theatrical. It is the intention of parents in such families to make it plain to their children that they all play cultural and not societal roles. that they are only roles, and that they are all truly concrete persons behind them. Therefore, children also learn that they have a family only by choosing to have it, by a collective act to be a family with each other. 62. Infinite sexuality does not focus its attention on certain parts or regions of the body. Infinite lovers have no private parts. They do not regard their bodies as having secret zones that can be exposed or made accessible to others for special favors. It is not their bodies but their persons they make accessible to others. The paradox of infinite sexuality is that by regarding sexuality as an expression of the person and not the body, it becomes fully embodied play. It becomes a drama of touching. The triumph of finite sexuality is to be liberated from play into the body. The essence of infinite sexuality is to be liberated into play with the body. In finite sexuality, I expect to relate to you as a body. In infinite sexuality, I expect to relate to you in your body. Infinite lovers conform to the sexual expectations of others in a way that does not expose something hidden, but unveils something in plain sight. That sexual engagement is a poiesis of free persons. In this exposure, they emerge as the persons they are. They meet others with their limitations and not within their limitations. In doing so, they expect to be transformed and are transformed. Chapter 4. A finite game occurs within a world. 63. A finite game occurs within a world. The fact that it must be limited temporally, numerically, and spatially means that there is something against which the limits stand. There is an outside to every finite game. Its limits are meaningless unless there is something to be limited, unless there is a larger space, a longer time, a greater number of possible competitors. There is nothing about a finite game in itself that determines at what time it is to be played, or by whom, or where. The rules of a finite game will indicate the temporal, spatial, and numerical nature of the game itself. That, for example, it will last 60 minutes, will be played on a field 100 yards in length, and by two teams of 11 players each. But the rules do not and cannot determine the date, the location, and the specific participants. There is nothing in the rules that requires professional teams composed of certain persons earning salaries of specified amounts, joining at the end of each season in a national championship. The rules for the practice of medicine or for the exercise of the office of the Bishop of Rome do not indicate which persons are to enter these games. Which kinds of persons, yes, but never the names of anyone. A world provides an absolute reference without which the time, place, and participants make no sense. Whatever occurs within a game is relatively intelligible with reference to whatever else has happened inside its boundaries. But it is absolutely intelligible with reference to that world for the sake of which its boundaries exist. It is relatively intelligible to have won an election for the presidency by a few thousand votes after a campaign of about 10 months. It is absolutely intelligible to be the 16th president of the United States, a society unambiguously marked off from all the rest of the world by its declared boundaries, in the 1,860th year of that world's history. We cannot have a precise understanding of what it means to be the winner of a contest until we can place the game in the absolute dimensions of a world. 64. World exists in the form of an audience. A world is not all that is the case, but that which determines all that is the case. An audience consists of persons observing a contest without participating in it. No one determines who an audience will be. No exercise of power can make a world. A world must be its own spontaneous source. A world worlds. Heidegger. Who must be a world cannot be a world. The number of persons who join an audience is irrelevant. So is the time and space in which an audience occurs. The temporal and spatial boundaries of a finite game must be absolute, in relation to an audience or a world. But when and where a world occurs, and whom it includes, is of no importance. One does not say, I was in the world, or audience, on November 22, 1963. But rather, I was just getting out of the car thinking about what to cook for dinner when I heard that the president had been shot. An audience does not receive its identity according to the persons within it, but according to the events it observes. Those who remember that day remember precisely what they were doing in the early afternoon of that day, not because it was the 22nd of November, but because it was at that moment that they became audience to the events of that day. If the boundaries of an audience are irrelevant, what is relevant is the unity of the audience. They must be a singular entity, bound in their desire to see who will win the contest before them. Anyone for whom this desire is not primary is not in the audience for that contest, and is not a person in that world. The fact that a finite game needs an audience before which it can be played, and the fact that an audience needs to be singularly absorbed in the events before it, show the crucial reciprocity of finite play and the world. Finite players need the world to provide an absolute reference for understanding themselves. Simultaneously, the world needs the feeder of finite play to remain a world. George Eliot's villainous character, Grandcourt, did not care a languid curse for anyone's admiration. But this state of non-caring, just as much as desire, required its related object. Namely, a world of admiring and envying spectators. For if you are fond of looking stonily at smiling persons, the persons must be there, and they must smile. We are players in search of a world as often as we are a world in search of players, and sometimes we are both at once. Some worlds pass quickly into existence and quickly out of it. Some sustain themselves for longer periods, but no world lasts forever. 65. There is an indefinite number of worlds. 66. The reciprocity of game and world has another deeper effect on the persons involved. Because the seriousness of finite play derives from the player's need to correct another's putative assessment of themselves, there is no requirement that the audience be physically present, since players are already their own audience. Just as in finite sexuality, where the absence or death of parents has no effect on the child's determination to prove them wrong, finite players become their own hostile observers in the very act of competing. I cannot be a finite player without being divided against myself. A similar dynamic is found in the audience. When sufficiently oblivious to their status as audience, the observers of a finite game become so absorbed in its conduct that they lose the sense of distance between themselves and the players. It is they, quite as much as the players, who win or lose. For this reason, the audience absorbs in itself the same politics of resentment that moves players to show they are not what they think others think they are. The audience is under the same constraint to disprove this judgment. When we ask where an audience will find its own audience, we discover the division inherent in all audiences. Each side of a conflict comes with its own partisan observers. Inasmuch as the conflict is expressed within the bounded playing of a game, the audience is unified, but its unity consists in its opposition to itself. We cannot become a world without being divided against ourselves. 67. Occurring before a world, theatrically, a finite game occurs within time. Because it has its boundaries, its beginning and end, within the absolute temporal limits established by a world, time for a finite player runs out. It is used up. It is a diminishing quantity. A finite game does not have its own time. It exists in a world's time. An audience allows players only so much time to win their titles. Early in a game, time seems abundant, and there appears a greater freedom to develop future strategies. Late in a game, time is rapidly being consumed. As choices become more limited, they become more important. Errors are more disastrous. We look on childhood and youth as those times of life rich with possibility only because there still seem to remain so many paths open to a successful outcome. Each year that passes, however, increases the competitive value of making strategically correct decisions. The errors of childhood can be more easily amended than those of adulthood. For the finite player in us, freedom is a function of time. We must have time to be free. The passage of time is always relative to that which does not pass, to the timeless. Victories occur in time, but the titles won in them are timeless. Titles neither age nor die. The points of reference for all finite history are signal triumphs meant never to be forgotten. Establishment of the throne of David, the birth of the Savior, the journey to Medina, the Battle of Hastings, the American, French, Russian, Chinese, and Cuban revolutions. Time divided into periods is theatrical time. The lapse of time between the opening and closing of an era is a scene between curtains. It is not a time lived, but a time viewed by both players and audience. The periodization of time presupposes a viewer existing outside the boundaries of play, able to see the beginning and the end simultaneously. The outcome of a finite game is the past waiting to happen. Whoever plays toward a certain outcome desires a particular past. By competing for a future prize, finite players compete for a prized past. 68. The infinite player in us does not consume time, but generates it. Because infinite play is dramatic and has no scripted conclusion, its time is time lived and not time viewed. As an infinite player, one is neither young nor old, for one does not live in the time of another. There is therefore no external measure of an infinite player's temporality. Time does not pass for an infinite player. Each moment of time is a beginning. Each moment is not the beginning of a period of time. It is the beginning of an event that gives the time within it its specific quality. For an infinite player, there is no such thing as an hour of time. There can be an hour of love, or a day of grieving, or a season of learning, or a period of labor. An infinite player does not begin working for the purpose of filling up a period of time with work, but for the purpose of filling work with time. Work is not an infinite player's way of passing time, but of engendering possibility. Work is not a way of arriving at a desired present and securing it against an unpredictable future, but of moving toward a future which itself has a future. Infinite players cannot say how much they have completed in their work, or love, or quarreling, but only that much remains incomplete in it. They are not concerned to determine when it is over, but only what comes of it. For the finite player in us, freedom is a function of time. We must have the time to be free. For the infinite player in us, time is a function of freedom. We are free to have time. A finite player puts play into time. An infinite player puts time into play. 69. Just as infinite players can play any number of finite games, so too can they join the audience of any game. They do so, however, for the play that is in observing, quite aware that they are audience. They look, but they see that they are looking. Infinite play remains invisible to the finite observer. Such viewers are looking for closure, for the ways in which players can bring matters to a conclusion and finish whatever remains unfinished. They are looking for the way time has exhausted itself, or will soon do so. Finite players stand before infinite play as they stand before art, looking at it, making a poema of it. If, however, the observers see the poesis in the work, they cease at once being observers. They find themselves in its time, aware that it remains unfinished, aware that their reading of the poetry is itself poetry. Infected then by the genius of the artist, they recover their own genius, becoming beginners with nothing but possibility ahead of them. If the goal of finite play is to win titles for their timelessness, and thus eternal life for oneself, the essence of infinite play is the paradoxical engagement with temporality that Meister Eckhart called eternal birth. Chapter 5. Nature is the realm of the unspeakable. 70. Nature is the realm of the unspeakable. It has no voice of its own and nothing to say. We experience the unspeakability of nature as its utter indifference to human culture. The master player in us tolerates this indifference scarcely at all. Indeed, we respond to it as a challenge, an invitation to confrontation and struggle. If nature will offer us no home, offer us nothing at all, we will then clear and arrange a space for ourselves. We take nature on as an opponent to be subdued for the sake of civilization. We count among the highest achievements of modern society the development of a technology that allows us to master nature's vagaries. The effort has largely taken the form of theatricalizing our relation to nature. Like any master player, we have been patiently attentive to the slightest clues in our opponent's behavior, as a way of preparing ourselves against surprise. Like hunters stalking their prey, we have learned to mimic the movements of nature, waiting for the chance to take hold of them before they get away from us. Nature, to be commanded, must be obeyed. Bacon. It is as though, by learning its secret script, we have learned to direct its play as well. There is little left to surprise us. The assumption guiding our struggle against nature is that deep within itself, nature contains a structure, an order, that is ultimately intelligible to the human understanding. Since this inherent structure determines the way things change, and is not itself subject to change, we speak of nature being lawful, of repeating itself according to quite predictable patterns. What we have done by showing that certain events repeat themselves according to known laws is to explain them. Explanation is the mode of discourse in which we show why matters must be as they are. All laws made use of in explanation look backward in time from the conclusion or the completion of a sequence. It is implicit in all explanatory discourse that just as there is a discoverable necessity in the outcome of past events, there is a discoverable necessity in future events. What can be explained can also be predicted if one knows the initial events and the laws covering their succession. A prediction is but an explanation in advance. Because of its thorough lawfulness, nature has no genius of its own. On the contrary, it is sometimes thought that the grandest discovery of the human genius is the perfect compatibility between the structure of the natural order and the structure of the mind, thereby making a complete understanding of nature possible. One may say, the eternal mystery of the world is its comprehensibility. Einstein. This is as much as to say that nature does have a voice, and its voice is no different from our own. We can then presume to speak for the unspeakable. This achievement is often raised as a sign of the great superiority of modern civilization over the many faded and lost civilizations of the ancients. While our great skill lies in finding patterns of repetition under the apparent play of accident and chance, less successful civilizations dealt with the threats of natural accident by appealing to supernatural powers for protection. But the voices of the gods prove to be ignorant and false. They have been silenced by the truth. 71. There is an irony in our silencing of the gods. By presuming to speak for the unspeakable, by hearing our own voice as the voice of nature, we have had to step outside the circle of nature. It is one thing for physics and chemistry to be speaking about nature. It is quite another for physics and chemistry to be the speaking of nature. No chemist would want to say that chemistry is itself chemical, for our speaking cannot be both chemical and about chemistry. If speaking about a process is itself part of the process, there is something that must remain permanently hidden from the speaker. To be intelligible at all, we must claim that we can step aside from the process and comment on it objectively and dispassionately, without anything obstructing our view of these matters. Here lies the irony. By way of this perfectly reasonable claim, the gods have stolen back into our struggle with nature. By depriving the gods of their own voices, the gods have taken ours. It is we who speak as supernatural intelligences and powers, masters of the forces of nature. This irony passes unnoticed only so long as we continue to veil ourselves against what we can otherwise plainly see. Nature allows no master over itself. Bacon's principle works both ways. If we must obey to command, then our commanding is only obeying and not commanding at all. There is no such thing as an unnatural act. Nothing can be done to or against nature, much less outside it. Therefore, the ignorance we thought we could avoid by an unclouded observation of nature has swept us back into itself. What we thought we read in nature, we discover we have read into nature. We have to remember that what we observe is not nature in itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. Heisenberg. 72. We are speaking now of no ordinary ignorance. It is not what we could have known, but do not. It is unintelligibility itself, that which no mind can ever comprehend. Unveiled, aware of the insuperable limitation placed against all our looking, we come back to nature's perfect silence. Now we can see that it is a silence so complete, there is no way of knowing what it is silent about, if anything. What we learn from the silence is the unlikeness between nature and whatever we could think or say about it. But this silence has an irony of its own. Far from stupefying us, it provides an indispensable condition to the mind's own originality. By confronting us with radical unlikeness, nature becomes the source of metaphor. Metaphor is the joining of like to unlike, such that one can never become the other. Metaphor requires an irreducibility, an imperturbable indifference of its terms for one another. The falcon can be the kingdom of daylight's dolphin, only if the daylight could have no dolphin, could indeed have nothing to do with dolphins. At its root, all language has the character of metaphor, because no matter what it intends to be about, it remains language, and remains absolutely unlike whatever it is about. This means that we can never have the falcon, only the word falcon. To say that we have the falcon and not the falcon is to presume again that we know precisely what it is we have, that we can see it in its entirety, and that we can speak as nature itself. The unspeakability of nature is the very possibility of language. Our attempt to take control of nature, to be master player in our opposition to it, is an attempt to rid ourselves of language. It is the refusal to accept nature as nature. It is to deafen ourselves to metaphor, and to make nature into something so familiar, it is essentially an extension of our willing and speaking. What the hunter kills is not the deer, but the metaphor of the deer, the deer. Killing the deer is not an act against nature, it is an act against language. To kill is to impose a silence that remains a silence. It is the reduction of an unpredictable vitality to a predictable mass, the transformation of the remote into the familiar. It is to rid oneself of the need to attend to its otherness. The physicists who look at their objects within their limitations teach physics. Those who see the limitations they place around their objects teach physics. For them, physics is a poiesis. 73. If nature is the realm of the unspeakable, history is the realm of the speakable. Indeed, no speaking is possible that is not itself historical. Students of history, like students of nature, often believe they can find unbiased, direct views of events. They look in on the lives of others, noting the multitude of ways those lives have been limited by the age in which they were lived. But no one can look in on an age, even if it is one's own age, without looking out of an age as well. There is no refuge outside history for such viewers, any more than there is a vantage outside nature. Since history is the drama of genius, its relentless surprise tempts us into designing boundaries for it, searching through it for patterns of repetition. Historians sometimes speak of trends, of cycles, of currents, of forces, as though they were describing natural events. In doing so, they must dehistoricize themselves, taking a perspective from the timeless, believing that each observed history is always of others, and never of themselves. That each observation is of history, but not itself historical. Genuine historians, therefore, reverse the assumption of the observers of nature that the observation itself cannot be an act of nature. Historians who understand themselves to be historical abandon explanation altogether. The mode of discourse appropriate to such self-aware history is narrative. Like explanation, narrative is concerned with the sequence of events and brings its tale to a conclusion. However, there is no general law that makes this outcome necessary. In a genuine story, there is no law that makes any act necessary. Explanations place all apparent possibilities into the context of the necessary. Stories set all necessities into the context of the possible. Explanation can tolerate a degree of chance, but it cannot comprehend freedom at all. We explain nothing when we say that persons do whatever they do because they choose to do it. On the other hand, causation cannot find a place in narrative. We have not told a story when we show that persons do whatever they do because they were caused to do it, by their genes, their social circumstances, or the influence of the gods. Explanations settle issues, showing that matters must end as they have. Narratives raise issues, showing that matters do not end as they must, but as they do. Explanation sets the need for further inquiry aside. Narrative invites us to rethink what we thought we knew. If the silence of nature is the possibility of language, language is the possibility of history. 74. Successful explanations do not draw attention to themselves as modes of speaking, because what is explained is not itself subject to history. If I explain to you why cold water sinks to the bottom of the pond and ice rises to the surface, I certainly do not intend my explanation to be true now and not later. The explanation is true anywhere and any time. That I choose to explain this to you in this time and place, however, is historical. It is an event, the narrative of our relation with each other. There must, therefore, be a reason for the speaking of this verity. Explanations are not offered gratuitously, just because, say, ice happens to float. I can explain nothing to you unless I first draw your attention to patent inadequacies in your knowledge, discontinuities in the relations between objects, or the presence of anomalies you cannot account for by any of the laws known to you. You will remain deaf to my explanations until you suspect yourself of falsehood. Many of these suspicions are, of course, minor, requiring merely small adjustments in one's views, incurring no doubt whatsoever concerning those views. Major challenges, however, are too serious to be met with argument or with sharpened explanation. They call either for outright and wholesale rejection or for conversion. One does not cross over from Manichaeism to Christianity or from Lamarckianism to Darwinism by a mere adjustment of views. True conversions consist in the choice of a new audience, that is, of a new world. All that was once familiar is now seen in startlingly new ways. As theatrical as conversions are, they remain oblivious to the degree to which choice is involved in the passage from one world to another. Radical conversions especially veil themselves against their own arbitrariness. Augustine, the most famous convert of antiquity, was puzzled that he could have held so firmly to so many different falsehoods. He was not astounded that there are so many different truths. His conversion was not from explanation to narrative, but from one explanation to another.